Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers who bridge our two worlds. This podcast was brought to you by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. Today on Korean Context, I have the opportunity to speak with Richard V. Allen, who, in the weeks preceding his official instatement as National Security Advisor to President-elect Ronald Reagan, was involved in a secret agreement to intervene on behalf of liberal political leader Kim Dae-jung, who had been sentenced to death by the then-Korean government under Chun Doo-hwan. The details of this story have only recently become known, even to Kim Dae-jung himself, who, nearly 20 years later, became the 15th president of South Korea. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Korean Context. We're very fortunate to have Mr. Richard V. Allen joining us in the studio today. Mr. Allen served as President Ronald Reagan's first national security advisor. Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Mr. Allen, this was, as I'm sure you remember, a very tumultuous time in South Korean history. In late 1979, Chun Doo-hwan led a coup d'etat that led to his declaring martial law in South Korea in 1980. That same year, Kim Dae-jung was arrested and sentenced to death by Chun's government, though various sources now say that Chun was holding off on carrying out the death sentence until after the end of the Carter administration at the end of 1980. It was actually during the short time after Reagan's election, but before his inauguration, that you intervened on behalf of Kim Dae-jung, and you are now largely credited with having saved his life.
I would say that while I was the instrument and perhaps the generator of the idea of how to do it, and it was a very elaborate, secret undertaking, the real power that I derived in order to be able to represent the United States when I should not have been representing the United States, namely Reagan hadn't been inaugurated yet, was with Ronald Reagan himself and the fact that he had won the election. I don't know how deeply you want to go into that story, but it was a rather exciting story. And
I'd love to hear it from you.
A pins and needles story, if you want to get at it. So I'll be as succinct as I can. After Ronald Reagan won the presidency and after I was appointed as National Security Advisor, I had an urgent call from a leading and a wonderful military figure in the United States, General Jack Vesey, who was known to be extraordinarily friendly and close to Korea because he, of course, had commanded our forces in Korea, and he was well-loved and respected by all. Was then the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army. And I didn't know General Vesey at the time, but I knew him by reputation, and I got a call here in Washington at our transition headquarters asking me urgently to come to his house to discuss a national security matter. Well, we had pledged hands off on all national security matters because there's only one president at a time. And we were in the delicate phase of not knowing whether our hostages in Iran would be released. So we were being extra cautious. But having known quite a bit about Korea, having first been sent there by Richard Nixon in 1968, before Mr. Nixon was ever even a candidate, to deliver a message to President Park Chung-hee, and I arrived 4 days after the attempted assassination of Park Chung-hee, when the North Korean squad got onto the steps of the Blue House, and the last of the squad was killed there. I naturally wanted to find out more about this urgent national security matter, so I went to General Vesey's home over here at Fort McNair. And there also was a Korean gentleman, and General Vesey introduced me to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Lu Byung-hyun, who was a very personable fellow. And as we sat down to breakfast, it was early in the morning on a cold winter day, General Liu said, "I'm here to discuss the conduct of the execution of the sentence on Kim Dae-jung, the death sentence." And I said very simply, quickly, "Fortunately, I'm not speaking about that in this house." And General Vesey was somewhat perturbed by that, and General Liu was, and I said, but I will walk with you outside, because I wasn't going to run the risk of being overheard, taped, wired, or anything else. And the wind was whistling outside, so after breakfast, General Liu, an annoyed General Liu, and I went outside, bundled up, and walked alone along the banks of the Anacostia there with the wind whistling. I made sure we were going, I was upwind, or downwind rather, and so my voice wouldn't be picked up in any recorder. And there I told him I didn't believe that he was here on a mission from President Chun Doo-hwan. I don't believe it, I said. And he was mightily insulted. I said, if you are the right person, come back in 2 weeks, and I'll be able to discuss this with you.
Well, that bought you some time.
Well, that's all I wanted to do, because I needed to talk with my boss, absolutely, who was in California, and I was here running my end of the transition. So I called the president-elect, Governor Reagan, and told him what it is, and we discussed it, and he said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you handle it your way? And I said, okay, and I understood that that if I had I was violating the promise to stay away from foreign affairs, but this was too urgent, too important. Besides, I had been asked by Secretary Muskie himself, the Secretary of State at the time, in his living room in his house on Massachusetts Avenue, when he had called me urgently to ask us to intervene in denouncing jointly with the Carter administration, the Korean government, for intending to carry out this sentence. And I simply said, Ed, Senator, Mr. Secretary, I'm just here to listen. I'll report to my boss. And that was my mode throughout the entire transition. I met daily with the Deputy Secretary of State and sometimes with the Secretary of State to receive briefings on the hostages and other things, but we never took a position on anything, just trying to stay true to the word. So Ed Muskie said to me, well, Dick, this Kim Dae-jung is a Catholic. I'm Catholic and you're Catholic, and on that basis alone we ought to do something to try to save our fellow member of the faith. I was impressed by that, but it wasn't the primary motivating force, but it was a big consideration. So I decided to play along. 2 weeks later, another general appeared on my doorstep, and not the same one. He had come with instructions from President Chun Doo-hwan, came with the ambassador, Kim Yong-sik, and with the CIA station chief here in Washington. And CIA station chief threw the ambassador out of the meeting, which was interesting and embarrassing. It was in my private offices. I had the presence of mind to have a note taker there who was my lifelong friend, a colonel in the United States Army, whom I had summoned back from his post to sit there because he was the one I could trust. And we went through this little session. They announced that they were going to kill Kim Dae-jung. That was the only way to start clean.
To start the relationship with the incoming
Reagan
administration.
Yes, I wasn't clear. Okay. A new relationship with the Reagan administration, cleaning the decks, so to speak, or clearing the decks and cleaning the slate. That's, of course, not the way to clean the slate. That would have sent everyone into paroxysms of fury.
Did they come, if I may, did they come in expecting you to agree that this would be a way to start a clean slate?
Well, at the time, I have to say, Martha, that the level of sophistication of the Korean government in regards to policies regarding America, this was not Park Chung-hee, remember. This was a military coup d'etat, and all of the military people were in place. One wouldn't expect them really to have any understanding of the American political system, how it worked, but used to that kind of dealing, backroom dealing. And, of course, that's a very impressive way to deal, and sometimes it works very well. I found out in this case I was able to use that to our advantage and to Kim Dae-jung's advantage. But I draw the story out too much. Let me try to shorten it for the purposes of this interview, although it is quite historic in my own mind, and it'll be a very prominent piece in my memoir, if I ever get the memoir finished.
Please do.
So I decided that, of course, it would be better that if we burned my reputation rather than my boss's, and he obviously thought that too, it was okay if I made the big mistake or if it should backfire. I told the general to come back another day. I kept postponing this and kept the president-elect briefed on what I was going to do. He approved. He just listened. He didn't say anything. That was proper on his part. I was the one taking this little gamble and doing it independently of the State Department. So he came back and he said, well, what's the answer? And I said, well, if you do that, if you do carry out this sentence, it will be like a bolt of lightning striking Korea. And he said, what does that mean? And I said, I don't have any intention of telling you. Of course, I didn't know exactly what it was anyway, but I wanted that. So come back another day. And he came back and said, all right, I've talked with Seoul. If President Chun Doo-hwan is invited as an official guest to the inauguration of President Reagan, then we will consider altering the death sentence. And then I knew I had them.
I had that them they wanted the something from them.
Well, they wanted something.
Yeah.
They wanted recognition. And since they didn't know, given their level of sophistication, that the matter of inauguration is a private affair and no head of state ever comes to an American president's inauguration, I just thought, gotcha. And I said, well, I'll think it over. Come back another day. Pick another day. And I said, I will arrange a meeting between your president, Chun Doo-hwan, and President Reagan, but not at the inauguration. It will not be a state visit. It will be a call in Washington, and we will have a chat. But that is the maximum. Now, that was to our advantage, because at the time, relations with Korea were in very poor shape. Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, had threatened to withdraw troops from Korea. There was a lot of bad feeling about that particular aspect, especially it was Carter's threat. And while they wanted to do good, they didn't really take the right course. And so I think you have to work with persuasion as well as with threats. And we had no real national security interest in removing our troops from Korea then, or even for that matter now entirely. So that was the story, and I said, now if one word of this leaks before January 21st, the day after the inauguration, late in the afternoon, when I will brief the press that such a meeting will occur in about 10 days, if anything that leaks, I'm going to deny the whole deal. The whole deal is off, and then I knew I really would have them. I carried it out very faithfully. Our ambassador, Gleystein, learned about it. I announced it in the afternoon. He learned about it on the tennis court in Korean time the next morning. And he's never been a fan of mine, probably still is not. But we achieved the purpose. Chun Doo-hwan came. I forced not come directly to Washington, because a state visit indicates that you come directly to Washington or to Williamsburg. That's the protocol. I made the party stop in Los Angeles first, and then New York, and then Washington. We had a meeting, a lunch, and then
rather than a formal dinner of some sort.
Oh, absolutely. I said no dinner, mm-hmm. No dinner, nothing, none of the trappings of a state visit. And so that was that. Kim Bae-jung was saved, and I later was asked by the president to persuade President Chun to let Kim Bae-jung go abroad. Kim Bae-jung went abroad for medical treatment under that, quotation marks, medical treatment, went to Harvard, and began denouncing Ronald Reagan as a man who coddled dictators, and so did most of his party.
I wanted to ask you about that, because that indicates that he really didn't know many details about what went on behind the scenes.
Yes, at the time he didn't know anything. Nothing.
So he had no idea that you had intervened and specifically to save his life, and that was why he was in the U.S. at that point?
Well, one could argue that. He could have gone to Germany or to France or someplace else, but I don't know. I'm not exactly certain, but when I approached him in his party headquarters in Yeouido several years later, I asked him to stop denouncing President Reagan. We didn't coddle any dictators. Any coddling, whatever we did, we coddled and resulted in saving your life. And KDJ said to me, is that really true? I said, yes, that's true. I gave him the chapter and the verse. He said, I didn't know that story. Will you come back tomorrow and explain this all to my faction? So my party faction. So I went back down to Yoido the next morning, and there was a conference room, and there were 30 or 40 people in the big conference room. KDJ sat right next to me. I'll never forget. The news media were there in force, NBC and so on and so forth. Very interesting. But not a word appeared in the press the next day, and not one word was on television. It was controlled press.
Now, what if it had come out before January 21st that you and, by extension, Reagan had been involved in this deal before his inauguration? I mean, what were the risks that Reagan and his administration were facing with that?
I would say, to summarize in a short word, trouble. Big trouble, two words. It would have been very difficult, although not universally unpopular. But that we had done this despite the urgings of the Carter administration to join with them. We thought that joining with the Carter administration would not be a good idea because we didn't, after all, President Carter was on the way out. And all we did was a good deed. Now, I want to tell you something very interesting, because when President came for the inauguration, I think the day, as I recall, it was the day before, we went up the hill, and we were in Senator Paul Laxalt's office. Senator Paul Laxalt was a very close friend of Ronald Reagan. He was governor of Nevada when Reagan was governor of California, and they formed a very close intellectual bond. And there was a crowd of senators in the office, and I got a call from the White House switchboard, and it was that President Carter wanted to talk to President Reagan, or President-elect Reagan. And so I handed the phone to the boss, and he went over into the corner in this noisy room where people were chattering. I could see him put one finger in an ear. He would do that. And he said, well, yes. Well, you're most welcome. I was very glad to be of help. Yes, yes. Well, thank you very much. And he held the phone. They had discovered, I guess they had discovered this back channel effort before it had been announced, because I didn't announce it till the day after the inauguration, and then in a routine way from the White House press room. This, that, and the other thing, we're going to do this, that, and by the way, the President of Korea will be here, and then right, I just blended it in. Koreans played it up as a big summit meeting, but this was the day before, and Reagan was a great president, a great man, a great friend and idol for me. I was happy to be of assistance to him and serve him. But he didn't often give compliments. And I'll never forget, he turned to me after that call. I put the phone down, and he said, well, I don't know what you did, but thank you. It's really quite nice, quite moving. And not because he didn't hand out thanks very often, because he was a grateful person, but it was his style. Do your job. I was just doing what I considered to be my interpretation of the job, and we got lucky. So Kim Dae-jung, I went the next day, and his party members criticized me mercilessly. Oh, Reagan, dictator, friend of dictators. And it was very unpleasant. No word appeared about it, and my side of the story didn't appear in the press. And I maintained a friendship with KDJ over the years, and it happened that I was in Seoul the day before he died, went to the hospital at Severance Hospital and saw Mrs. Kim and looked in on him, but he was not in any shape, and came outside, and a bevy of reporters wanted to talk to me, but they didn't know who I was, and that was just fine with me, so I didn't tell them. I just, who are you? That's the Korean press. Who are you? Well, I'm just a guy with a, you know, I brought in the lunch. So the next day, this story was more or less out in the press. And so I'd become friendly with him in the meantime. I even campaign for him here. I spoke at fundraisers in the Korean-American community.
And this was later when he was running for the presidency in South Korea.
Yes, I wore a KDJ button. And then when he was elected, and I had some disagreements with him on a number of things, but I called on him at Chung-Hwa-dae a number of times, as I did other presidents, such as No Tae-woo and Chun-Doo-Hwan. I also ran the torch in the 88 Olympics, by the way. I was the only Miguk to run the torch with my 13-year-old daughter, and No Tae-woo gave me the torch.
He kept
the torch. I ran in Yeouido for 1 kilometer with the sparks of the magnesium flame dripping on my arm.
Small price to pay, I would
still
say,
have scars. I have the torch, and I have a great,
oh, do you?
Great pictures. My friend Lee Kun-hee, the chairman of Samsung, had his photographer from the newspaper. What is their newspaper? Chung-Hwa-dae. Yeah. And he gave me the actual photographs. I have the wonderful photographs of my daughter and myself running the torch.
Fantastic. If I may ask you about the political situation in the United States at around this time, the transition between Carter and Reagan, I'm curious to hear from you what note the Carter administration was ending its relationship with South Korea on, and what the expectations were for the incoming Reagan administration.
Expectations on the Korean side?
I'd be interested in hearing both, the Korean side and American side.
Well, avoiding all partisanship here, I would say that the relationship had been very badly damaged by the threat to withdraw troops, and it was hard to walk that back.
And that had happened in 1979 when Carter was in
South Korea. And it was a very curious incident. I later talked to a man whose name I've lamentably forgotten, who was the interpreter, who happened to be in the car driving someplace in Korea at that time with President Carter and President Park Chung-hee. And he asked President Park, Carter handed him a Bible, according to this interpreter, who was the only one apparently in the car. I can't believe that we didn't have our interpreter in the car, too, but this is what the fellow told me. Very distinguished, incredible man. Handed him Park Chung-hee a Bible and said, I'd like to ask you to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior.
President Carter did that?
That's what I'm told. I can't say that I wasn't there, so I don't know. And that was a very, very odd situation. And I know that I know of President Carter's passion for human rights. I think it has a different tinge to it than others, and there are various ways to protect human rights. And this was a specific case of Kim Dae-jung. But of course, by the time President Carter's visit, Gwangju had not occurred, and that was
the Democratic uprising, or the start of the southwestern part.
And of course, this kind of factionalism, regionalism in Korea has always played a part. I mean, after all, Asiana Airlines got its start because it was a more or less a gift, a sop, to Gwangju people. It was a nice sop. I thought it was a good idea to start another airline. And it's a good airline. I fly it from time to time. So this factionalism, this regionalism, is more intense than any other place that I know of in the modern world, as I say. Probably not among tribal differentiations in Africa or even in the Middle East, but Gwangju was a place apart, and everyone knows that. And if you don't know that, why, I think you missed out on something. It's not so pronounced or accentuated today in this era of modern communication, especially in the country such as Korea, which is the most wired country in the world. So, but the expectations were that, well, we wanted to improve relations, and this ploy that we used in what amounted to, in the end, to what's called by some the rescue of Kim Dae-jung, was part and parcel of getting us well again in terms of our relationship with Korea. There was a price to pay, and the price was, for a long time, that Ronald Reagan was thought to be a friend of dictators. We never really got over that. And you've talked to the young academic generation today, the younger academic generation today in Korea, and you'll still get a lot of that. And of course, there's a lot of blame America thinking among the Korean intelligentsia and intellectual class, even now today. We do all things wrong. That's the nature of a relationship.
I'm actually interested in hearing from you about what you, to continue speaking about the current relationship between the United States and South Korea. Obviously, the relationship between our country and South Korea has been quite strong recently, with the relationship between Lee Myung-bak and President Obama being so strong. Do you expect that to continue over the next few years?
Well, I would certainly hope so.
I mean, I should also add that we have a presidential election occurring in 2012 here, obviously, but also in South Korea. I mean, there are a lot of leadership changes.
How will I know?
Potentially in the works.
How will I know? I was not long ago in Korea and spoke with, shall we say, some of the potential candidates for the office. One of the nice things about new Korean customs is one term and out. Serve one term as president and then you're out. That's a very good step toward democracy. I might say there were some major goals in the Reagan administration. And I think among the foremost goals was the prosecution of democracy abroad. And one of the, or three of the successes of the Reagan administration are often unheralded, and they should be accentuated in my view. And that is the pressures toward democracy in the Philippines. In other words, if you put it bluntly, getting rid of Marcos and the Marcos regime, which Ronald Reagan effectuated. The pressures in Taiwan, I know, because I was part and parcel of the meetings that Reagan had with Chiang Ching-kuo, the president of Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang Ching-kuo in 1978, pressuring toward democracy, and those pressures we kept on during 1980 and 81, 82, and stayed on until we came into a full-fledged democracy, and the same is true of Korea. Now, no one can claim credit for it, only the people themselves having the common sense to move toward democracy as disorderly as it is. So, I know President Lee Myung-bak. I've known him for a long time, since he was with the Hyundai Corporation, and my great good friend Chung Ju-young, the revered patriarch, founder of the Hyundai dynasty, so to speak, and his family. And I have great confidence that a worthy successor is going to be picked. I lament greatly that we cannot get this free trade agreement through the Congress. I think it's a shame. And I have my own doubts that the president is leading on this issue. I don't think he is, but I can say that because I'm independent.
That President Obama is leading on this issue.
President Obama, that's right. And really, this is an absolutely vital agreement to get through.
So I'd like to hear more about what you've been working on these days.
Well, right now, I'm trying to push my memoir into some sort of shape that will eventually allow me to publish it. My time spans from my early days in university in 1950s, when I first met Richard Nixon, met him again in 57 after I was graduated and was here in Washington working for the summer for the National Security Agency. Kept in touch with him, sent him my articles. I was doing my doctoral work in Germany in 1960 when he ran against Kennedy, but I kept him informed. I started writing. I was one of the co-founders of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, in 1962, and sent him my books and articles, and we had a lively correspondence. In 1966, I went to the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford, and by 1967, he had asked me to come to New York, and I didn't really quite want to go to New York to run the prepare for the foreign policy business for him, but did go in 68, took leave of absence from Hoover, where I'm still a senior fellow. And all this time is valuable, and I have seen some things that other people have never seen, and I've been able to tell some stories that have never been told, or if told, were not told accurately, because I have good notes. So that's my my occupation now, is to try to figure out what I'm going to do with this memoir, and how I'm going to manage giving time to our family of 7 children, 22 grandchildren, and my supervisor, otherwise known as my wife.
Well, I can offer you a few valuable, very valuable seconds of airtime via podcast in the future when you are ready to make a plug for your memoir. And we look forward to hearing a lot more about the completion of your memoir and anything else that you'll continue to work on over the next few years.
I'd be delighted to come back.
Well, thank you very much, sir. It's been a real pleasure to speak
pleasure
with you today.
Pleasure has been mine. Thank you.
For more information about this episode, this podcast, and upcoming KEI events, please check out our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. As always, please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggested podcast topics to me at podcast@keia.org. I'd love to hear from you, so please don't be shy. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. It was a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Korean Context. Bye.